Today's program is brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit culinarycenter.com.
This is Sherry Bayer from All in the Industry. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Feast Your Ears. I'm Harry Rosenblum from the Brooklyn Kitchen, a cooking store located at 100 Frost Street in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Join me every Wednesday as I talk with people about what they do and how it influences their personal food stories. This is a show about people, life, and food. You can find Feast Your Ears, as well as lots of other great shows, at heritageradionetwork.org and on iTunes. Today is my 25th episode of Feast Your Ears. Thank you for listening. And today I have on the phone with me Lori Lieberman, who is author of a blog called Drop It and Eat, and author of two books called Food to Eat and Drop the Diet, about how we eat and how the foods that we eat relate to us and how we relate to them. Lori's been a nutrition consultant for more than 25 years in the Boston area and has experience with eating disorders, diabetes management, pediatric and prenatal nutrition, among many other things. Thanks, Lori, for joining me by phone.
My pleasure.
So I like to have, you know, I like to give an intro of my guests, but I find that people are usually better at describing themselves and introducing themselves than I am, especially in cases like this. So, you know, looking at your blog, you have your bio is very impressive. So I'm just wondering, you know, how do you describe yourself when you meet someone and they say, "Oh, Lori, what do you do? What do you say?"
Like, I guess it depends on who I'm with in terms of what I'd say, because if I'm at a cocktail party and I mention I'm a nutritionist, then I have to be careful because they'll be acting really strange around me.
Right.
But in the professional arena, what I would say is that I take a very behavioral approach to help people change their relationship with food. And that goes across all kinds of conditions, whether someone's struggling with diabetes management or weight management or an eating disorder. So that really permeates everything I do.
Yeah, I can imagine that if you tell people that you work as a nutrition consultant at a dinner party, that they're going to be watching everything you eat and feel like you're watching everything they eat.
Yeah, it's often quite a surprise to people how much I really like food and good food and pastries and butter and good wine. So, yeah, they're often in for a surprise, I have to say.
Yeah. How did you first become interested in the line of study, in working with people about nutrition and eating disorders and diabetes management?
Well, a quick answer in terms of my interest in nutrition, I'd say it was sparked from an intro nutrition class I took when I was at Brown my freshman year. It was the only class they offered in nutrition, and it really wowed me. I really decided from that point, really at that point, to pursue a career in nutrition. I'd say in terms of the eating disorder part, I had struggled with my own eating disorder when I was in college, really early stages of anorexia, and then binge eating disorder for quite some time, which I recovered from. So I'd say that there was always an interest in that area. The diabetes management just evolved from seeing patients, you know, with various conditions, and I did additional training to have an expertise in diabetes management. Mm-hmm. I'd say the real love of eating disorder treatment only evolved seeing a wealth of patients with eating disorders, and largely because I don't think there's anything as rewarding as seeing a patient who's really struggling. And this is, you know, eating disorders are life-threatening conditions.
Sure.
But to see someone with an eating disorder and to feel like, you know, you helped save their life, and to be told many a time that I saved a child's life or, you know, the individual's life or got them on track, there's really nothing that's as rewarding as that.
So. Yeah, I think that, you know, it is important to recognize, especially in the food space, right? I mean, this radio show, this radio station, my business, we're all sort of operating in the food space and often coming mm-hmm. from a point of view of celebrating food. And I think it's, and I feel like there's a lot of talk, certainly for us, you know, we throw lots of events, we throw lots of fundraisers related to people who don't have enough food. And I feel like there's a lot of talk about that, but I think it's important to, you know, to think about and recognize that that's not the only sort of issue around food that people have, and that there are people who have trouble, you know, with how they eat or don't eat, and having to do with body image and that sort of stuff. Which then led to your book, Food to Eat, which you wrote with a co-author.
So do you want me to respond to that a little bit?
Yeah, can you respond?
So a few things. Yes, I think it's unfortunate that eating disorders haven't gotten as much attention until more recently as they should, and especially with this kind of national anti-obesity movement. I don't think it's helped our cause at all, and I think in many ways it's set us back in terms of where our focus should be. In terms of educating kids and adults and the kind of messages out there. And I'm happy to talk more about that in a little bit. As for the book, Food to Eat came about basically the initiative of Kate, my co-author, who started to follow my blog, Drop It and Eat. I'm getting some feedback on my side. I don't know if you can hear it there.
Sounds okay to me in the studio. Can you still hear me okay?
Yeah, okay, I'm okay there.
Okay.
That settled down. So I started writing a blog about, in 2010, actually, and one of my blog followers was a woman named Kate, who was from Melbourne, Australia. She's at the time, a woman in her, I think, late 30s and a mother of three daughters. And so she started to read, and as people do, leave comments and started to engage with me. After some time, she clearly started to trust what I had to say and, you know, would pose questions to me, and we developed a nice relationship. And at some point, she said she was looking for a book to kind of help support her recovery, which she had only just started, and was wondering, having not seen anything out there, was wondering about the possibility of jointly working on something, a recovery book of sorts, a recovery cookbook for people with eating disorders. So I said to her, I thought it was a great idea, but she and I had a very different vision for what this recovery, quote-unquote, cookbook would be. Hmm. Her idea was very disordered recipes, because that was still where she was at. So, for instance, you know, she was suggesting things like miso soup and salads, and I said to her, well, I like the concept, I don't support the content. So if we're going to do this, this really has to be your recovery book. It needs to have desserts, and it has to have real food, and it has to have things that I would cook myself. It has to have recipes I really enjoy.
Sure.
But written in a way that can still help people that are afraid to eat and afraid to eat enough and have a lot of food rules and rigidity about what's quote-unquote safe to eat. And so that was the purpose. I mean, for one thing, to help readers recognize that we know what we're talking about, that we understand what's going on in their heads, so that they can have what I refer to as a transference of trust, that, you know, if we get it, we can kind of help guide them get to a better place. So that's kind of how the book started.
It's an amazing process. To me, that you were in a place where, you know, you as someone who has a practice interacting with clients about these issues in person, right, using the tool of the internet to put that out there kind of to everybody, and you know, it's sort of.
I have to say, when I look back on it, I am completely blown away by the fact that we did it, mm-hmm. and also the power of virtual connection. And actually, subsequently, I've done some national speaking at conferences. And in fact, with Kate last year, Kate and I presented at an international eating disorder conference on a range of topics, but including the power of virtual connection. And I think it's just so fascinating. We literally wrote this virtually. You know, she's in, you know, across the world, and once a week we would have Skype sessions, and we would debate. That, you know, she would raise her eating disorder concerns, right. And I would counter the eating disorder concerns, and we would talk about everything from, you know, the number of recipes that to accommodate, you know, a more OCD concern about the numbers that had to be a certain way, or the typeface that had to be a certain way, to the quality of the recipes, to how much fat they can have, to how much sugar was okay, and addressing every level of, you know, basically to break down all the barriers that anyone living with an eating disorder has to go through every day they have to confront food and eating.
Right. And did you write the entire book that way, virtually, without ever meeting in person?
Correct. We wrote the entire book that way, and it was a very slow process. It complicated by the fact that, you know, this is a cookbook, so recipes needed to be tested, and, you know, we needed to make sure. Well, there were also issues because, you know, there are different units used in Australia and in Europe compared to in the U.S., and there were different words we use, so we had to deal with things like that. But basically, there were 25 recipes, 20 of which are mine, 5 are hers, and there were different levels of recipes in terms of how much engagement with the food there
is,
in terms of times and things of the sort. So basically, we negotiated all of this, and then she actually had to cook the recipes, and she had to taste all the recipes, and she was, you know, pretty entrenched in her eating disorder as she was starting this process, and so she had to get herself out of her own way
in order to write the book.
Support, right? And so she had to make the recipes, and then furthermore, the recipes were photographed by her husband, who is an amateur photographer and did a phenomenal job with the images. And if you got to look online, these are all his images.
That's great.
And so she had to taste it. You know, she had to taste. She had to make it. She had to deal with the food like all of the readers of these books will need to deal with.
Yep.
And she had to give her reaction to it, and the reactions weren't always so positive, and we put that out there too. So if there was something that made her very uneasy, she put it out there in her reaction, and I would counter it, and we'd have a little back and forth. And so it was a very real experience in recovery, because she was actively going through it at the time. We finally met after the book had been completely written but not yet published. We met at an international eating disorder conference that was being held in Austin, Texas. And it was a really fabulous experience. It was really, really wonderful. And as I mentioned, we got together again this past year. The conference was held in Boston, and we spoke at the conference, and she stayed with me for a week, which was fabulous.
That's amazing. And how has her recovery been?
So, you know, I think like recovery has ups and downs.
Yep.
I think she's in a much better place. She had I mentioned she started to follow the blog when she was in her late 30s, but she had an eating disorder since her teens that for decades had never been addressed.
Right.
So I think she's come a really long way, and like everybody has ups and downs with things like, you know, the eating disorder and you know, things like depression and anxiety, which are also really, really common situations in sufferers with eating disorders.
Yeah. And then your subsequent book is called Drop the Diet.
Yeah, so essentially Drop the Diet is the same book with a few things modified. So, you know, the covers are, if you look at them, look almost the same. And basically what happened is we started Food to Eat designed for people more with restrictive eating disorders, although it could have applied to anyone. And then we realized that when I would go and do speaking engagements, you know, no one was rushing up to buy a book that had, you know, basically saying, I have an eating disorder on the cover. And so we decided to broaden the audience a little bit and modified it to really change it to be overcoming your food rules. And in reality, it was very easy to keep much of the book exactly the same, because even people dealing with binge eating disorder or compulsive overeating or bulimia have an element of restrictive eating and rigidity and food rules and nutrition misinformation as a core component. And so it was very easy to modify it. You know, modifying the language and having a couple of extra insert pages that address their specific needs to help them feel more in control.
Sure, and the recipes were already tested, right? So you knew that the recipes worked and that they were delicious.
Oh, yeah, and that's all exactly the same. That's all exactly the same.
And it makes sense. I mean, it is a, you know, I have to imagine that it is a hard thing to start out from a point of you know, suddenly picking it up and saying, oh, well, maybe I do have an eating disorder. That
yeah,
is something
absolutely.
That, you know, and
yeah.
of course, in a public space doing that. I mean, it's one thing to order it online, but if you're seeing it in a public space and you're holding it and you're picking it up, that's a different thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we've actually, I'd say the biggest sales come from online where people can discreetly buy it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's general. And in my office, I have a lot of patients that buy it as well.
Lori, we're going to take a short break and hear from one of our sponsors,
sure.
And then when we come back, I want to touch on some of the things that we spoke about or touched on earlier about sort of nutrition misinformation and related to some pet peeves that you and I spoke about a few weeks ago.
Sounds great.
The International Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
Welcome back to Feast Your Ears. This is Harry Rosenblum from the Brooklyn Kitchen. I've been speaking today with Lori Lieberman about eating disorders and her blog, Drop It and Eat, and her books, Food to Eat, and also Drop the Diet. Lori, when we were corresponding before the show a few weeks ago, one of the questions I asked you is if you had any pet peeves, and that sparked a great blog post on your blog. If people want to take a look at that, the blog is dropitandeat.blogspot.com. And what Lori talked about in the post is having pet peeves related to the way not only that people react to food and nutrition, but also sort of things in society. So I just wanted to, you know, bring some of those up and sort of bring them to light on the radio. But I think what you mentioned earlier, this idea that the recovery or the treatment of eating disorders has been really set back by the national sort of interest in I guess, becoming skinnier. Right. So we have, you know, everywhere we look, there's diet books and there are, you know, workout tapes and workout apps and workout groups and all of these things. And the first thing that you mentioned in the blog really hit home for me, which is that, you know, people assume that weight loss is a good thing sort of
Absolutely.
Across the board. And that's very dangerous. It's very dangerous for someone who has an eating disorder or any of these sort of weight issues to operate under the assumption that, you know, if you're skinnier now than the last time you came to the doctor, that's positive.
Absolutely. It's a major problem. I would ask us all to consider that if you see somebody that you haven't seen in a while and your thought is, wow, you look great, you've lost weight, that you filter that thought and you ask them how they've been and if they've been well.
Right.
Because we have no idea about why someone might have lost weight or how they lost weight. So, you know, we have to be so careful to not reinforce unhealthy behaviors. I mentioned on the blog a situation that happened just a few weeks ago. My mom was going in for some surgery, and the nurse pre-op asked her some preliminary questions. And one of the questions she asked was, you know, have you had weight loss of more than 10 pounds in the last month? And my mother responded, yes. And the nurse at a reputable hospital, said, "Oh, that's great." I was floored by that. My mother, with a history of cancer, is told that that's great.
Sure.
And I found that appalling. And that's just one of a million examples. We see this pediatricians who have really great intentions and no doubt are biased by the, you know, the climbing obesity, quote-unquote, epidemic. They kind of lose sight of the fact that when they see a child who ought to be growing and gaining weight, lose weight, they don't stop to necessarily ask the questions of why and how. And they don't do the probing that needs to be done. So, I mean, that's a big pet peeve for me, for sure.
No, I 100% agree with you. I think that it's, you know, the same thing happened. You know, I watched a family member go through a very similar thing where, you know, she had cancer. And did lose weight, and you know, it was someone who had struggled with some amount of obesity for a long time. And I was in the room when someone said, "Oh, you look great. You lost weight." And you know, that was a really hard thing to hear, because for, you know, decades, of course, she had been doing Weight Watchers and trying to lose weight, but of course now was losing weight because she was dying.
Yes, yeah. I mean, the focus really should be put on the behavior and assessing the behaviors, and not on body mass index or weight. And similarly, you know, in schools, we shouldn't be, and right now the current campaign with some really lovely, visually lovely materials directs kids to calculate their calories and stay within a calorie limit. And to me, that is just the worst possible thing we could be directing children to do, or adults, but certainly children. I definitely don't support that.
Yeah, you point out on your blog also the idea of calling food by its nutrient, which is a personal one for me too. I hear people all the time say, "Oh, well, you know, what are we going to have for protein?"
Yeah, right. I know that one drives me crazy, but you know, it doesn't drive me quite as crazy as some of the way that people get scammed every day by really great marketing, like the almond milk one. So, like, 9 out of 10 people come into my office very proudly telling me they're drinking almond milk. And, you know, besides the fact that there is this bit of a, how should I put it? You know, people feel really pleased with themselves for making some what they perceive to be healthier choices. In the case of almond milk, the irony to me is that there's very little almond in almond milk. Mm-hmm. You know, it's only about a gram of protein per cup, which is significantly lower than cow's milk at 8 grams. You know, it doesn't have the fiber of almonds. It doesn't have the minerals of almonds. It's really fortified water. It's too low calorie to be called a milk compared to other milks. And yet people are expected to drink it and think that they're going to be satisfied the way a cup of milk would be satisfying. So I feel it's a great example of great, great marketing, great marketing campaigns. And I frequently have to point this one out to patients.
Yeah, I mean, as someone who operates a store where, you know, we sell a lot of food products, we're pitched a lot of food products, and you point out, and this is a personal one, it drives me crazy, on things that say high protein or low fat or gluten free, on things that you would never expect to have those. Like, the gluten free one drives me nuts, because you see things like beef jerky, for instance, often will say gluten free. Uh-huh. In what world is there ever gluten?
Right.
In
although
beef.
To be fair, if in fact, you know, if you're a patient who has celiac disease, not only do you want it to say gluten free, you know, is it helpful to have it flagged as gluten free, but it needs to be validated that it's been checked.
Sure.
Right now, the companies are putting the words gluten free on a product, but they're not doing testing to evaluate how many parts per million of gluten are in the product.
Sure. I mean, on the
so
back of that same package,
I think it has a negative consequence for people who seriously need to be watching their gluten.
Oh, of course. I mean, I don't mean to belittle celiac as an issue, and then, you know, but of course these same packages on the back say packed in a facility that also processes wheat.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, and if it is really an issue for you, then that's a huge, you know, that can be a huge problem. Well, I wanted to move away from pet peeves into something a little more, I think, positive or fun, I guess.
Sure.
I know that you have been baking a lot of sourdough recently.
I have indeed. What can I tell you about my sourdough?
Well, I wanted to hear, where your starter came from, and you know how often you bake. I have a starter. I've had many starters over the years. Some have been gifts. Some I've started, naturally. And at the moment, I have probably my longest running sourdough. I have a sourdough that I've had alive now for about 10 months or so, 9 months maybe.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And I try to use it at least once a week, sometimes more, sometimes a little less. I grew it outside on a bowl of flour and water on the coast of Maine, where I go every
Very
summer
impressive.
And wanted to sort of bring a piece of that, I guess, back home to New York with me, and so I would have it all the time.
Well, I won't poke fun at the start of your question, as in, what was the starter for
yes.
your sourdough making? But puns aside, my adventures with sourdough began Mother's Day this past year when my younger son, who's in his 20s, gave me some sourdough starter as part of a Mother's Day gift. His girlfriend worked at a bakery in Providence, which is a fabulous bakery called Seven Stars. And so I got their starter, and basically I've been adventuring, I've been going through the adventures of sourdough bread baking ever since, and it's been just a total obsession, totally loving it. I don't know if you looked at any of the pictures online. Did you get to look at?
I did. I mean, your loaves look fantastic.
Yeah, they're just like a complete thrill. So basically, every other week, I make 4 2-pound loaves.
Wow.
And let me just remind you, there's only me and my husband in my home at this point. And we managed to go through them with no trouble.
Yep.
Evidence that we practice what we preach, which is we eat lots of carbs,
yep.
and including white carbs, and don't seem any worse off for it. But in any case, so I make these breads, and then I cut them up and freeze them, and I've been, taking some daring strategies to add in porridges to the bread, seeds, and different kinds of fermenting, and it's been really a fabulous, fabulous experience.
That's great. I have been, I wish that I felt like I had the time to dig into actually making loaves of bread with mine. I've done a little bit of bread baking with mine, but I tend to use mine more as an addendum into other things. So I've managed to fit in making, I try to make a sourdough pancake or a sourdough waffle on the weekend mornings.
Yeah.
My children really like that. And then, I've been doing some sourdough flatbreads because those tend to be pretty quick and easy.
I think the key is really timing because it's a very long process, but you don't have to actually sit there and be present for it. So I've gotten into the routine now where I'll feed my starter on a Thursday night. I'm off on Friday. Friday morning, I'll do my first feed, my lavan, and then Saturday, I'm putting them in baskets already, and letting them have another rise. And so it's not like I have to sit around all weekend doing it.
Sure.
And then it's just it's a very creative outlet. I mean, I love the folds, and I love the scoring. I'm just completely enthralled with the sourdough thing. And then the whole other, getting back to the whole virtual world, I'm on Instagram now, and I find that, there's a whole world of crazy people like me who can't stop talking about their sourdough bread. And so I get all these communication from this international sourdough fanatics community. And so that's been a joy also, I have to say.
That's really wonderful. Well, Lori, it's been great talking today. I don't know if you have any other sort of remarks or things you wanted to bring up, either related to sourdough or to eating disorders or not, but we're just about out of time. Any speaking you're doing or any other books you have coming up?
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned. I am going to be speaking at an eating disorder conference in Massachusetts, the Meta Conference, in May. It's the second week in May. And I'd love people to read the blog. There's all kinds of things that foodies and people dealing with changing their relationship with food would benefit from, including there's a 25% off coupon if you go to the link if people are interested in getting the book. And I'll have to stop by again and visit you in your store. I really appreciate your having me on the show.
Thanks, Lori, and thank you for listening to Feast Your Ears. Big thank you to Kristen Baylor, my producer here, and David Tadashore for engineering the show. Please take a moment to like the show on Facebook and iTunes, and follow me on Instagram.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.